the dying embers of human existence as the asteroid, a behemoth the size of Texas, hurtles relentlessly toward Earth. The world braces for an apocalyptic end. Deep beneath the bunker, a refuge plunges into the bowels of the Earth. Here the Chosen gather, their purpose clear, to preserve the very soul of our civilization. The 35 and 70 millimeter prints that encapsulate the magic, the emotion, and the dreams of generations past. These masterpieces, each frame a testament to the human spirit, are carefully cataloged and cradled in the cavernous confines of the bunker. Perhaps there was room for more. For friends and family yearning for salvation, but sacrifices must be made. The moving Earth stand united, the keepers of a flame, promising a future where the art of storytelling endures, transcending the boundaries of time and space. God help us all.
Welcome to Back to the Framerate, part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. Join us as we watch and discuss films on VOD and streaming platforms, deliberating on whether each one is worthy of salvation or destined for destruction in the face of the impending asteroid apocalypse. I am Nathan Schur, and accompanying me are the extraordinary movie mavens, Brianna Butterworth, Ellie Escobar, and Sam Cole. My question this week isn't really a question, but a challenge to my co-hosts, and in the spirit of the show, it has very high stakes. I'm going to preface this with the statement that I think the thing, you know, sports some of the greatest facial hair in the history of cinema. So put that in the back of your heads, and here we go. Each of you are at a starting line, ready to run a race. 20 feet away are three items. When I say go, each of you in this challenge are running as fast as you can to the other side to pick up one of these. These items are one of the characters' facial hair features, and once one of the hosts claims it, it can't be picked by another host. I'm expecting chaos here, but that's the beauty of this challenge. So when I say go, all three of you better shout out which item you are selecting, and you must wear this for the duration of your time living in our fallout shelter. The three items are Kurt Russell's beard, Wilford Brimley's, a.k.a. Blake's eyebrows, or William Moffat, a.k.a. Gary's eyebrows. Go.
Beer. Kurt beer. Russell.
Oh, Moffat's eyebrows.
I got Kurt Russell beer.
It's going to haunt me.
So, Ellie, you get Kurt Russell's beard. You're wearing that for the next, who knows, decade. B, you are getting Moffat's eyebrows.
That's so pretty good.
And that means Sam. I don't remember you saying anything because it was really quiet.
You didn't say anything.
I said beard before Bye. Everyone, but that's okay.
You can don't lie. You just said that. Oh my god!
You can put me in the back. It's all right. What lame thing did I get?
Well, actually, I screwed that up. I actually meant to say Blair's sideburns. I screwed that up completely.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. I was thinking, like, why did you say two?
I know. I completely. Screwed the pooch on that right there. But just picture that instead of saying Blair's eyebrows, I meant Blair's sideburns. But I'm gonna pretend that that's what you said. That you're stuck with Blair's sideburns, Sam.
I'm actually not that sad after that I got the eyebrows then.
Okay. Wait, who was Blair? Remind me.
The diabetes guy.
Prime Minister of England, Tony Blair.
Who? Come on, remind me. There's so many men in there.
Cher's older brother, Blair. Do you know him?
This is going to be something I think we're going to talk about. The characters in here. And there's 12. There's a cast of 12 men in this movie.
Was he the white guy, Blair?
The white guy, yes. The white guy. Well, okay. So maybe that challenge went off the rails. But yeah, I've been debating all week, like, how can I kind of make this intro kind of fun? Yeah. And I screwed it up, but that's okay. Well, better luck next week. All right.
It was good. Listen,
I've been already challenged. I was already challenged by not being able to get my agenda.
We know.
It was so good. It was a barrel of pebbles.
So obviously the movie we are going to talk about this week is the 1982 film, The Thing. Now, before we get into the conversation on this, I always do a brief plot synopsis. I have to say, I was so disappointed finding a good plot synopsis online. I thought they were really unsatisfying. So I looked in IMDb, I looked on Wikipedia, Google. They were just written horribly. So I decided to completely lean into the stupidity and ask ChatGTP to write me a plot synopsis for this movie.
You stood that low?
Oh, well, it gets better. I asked ChatGTP to write me a plot synopsis for this movie with just one criteria. It had to be written for a six-year-old to understand. And here it is, because this is better. In the freezing cold of Antarctica, a bunch of buddies find a clever alien that can turn into anyone it touches. This makes things really confusing and makes everyone wonder who's still their friend. They have to use their brains to figure out who's real and who's been turned into the alien. There are some really creepy and yucky moments with the alien changing shape. The friends need to stick together, be smart, and outwit the alien to stay safe.
Very, very,
wow.
That sounded like a sci-fi Stand By Me.
I have to say, though, that was better than anything that was written on any of those other platforms.
No. Listeners, now you know what you're in for.
Okay.
And then at the end, when they beat the alien and they all get together and sing, the Goonies are good enough.
Oh, man.
And we'll just segue into our trailer as well, since we're on this part.
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside, where no one can see it, or hear it, or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
You guys gotta listen to Gary. He can beat one of those things.
Also not the greatest trailer either. Like, I found the marketing for this film just to be really subpar. And that might have been one of the reasons why this movie did not do so well in the box office. But we're going to get to that as well, I think. So, Sam, I'm going to segue over to you. Do you have some movie facts for us?
Indeed. So The Thing came out in the summer of 1982. It was directed by John Carpenter, of fame of many more films, The Halloween, and another one I like called The Fog. Written by Bill Lancaster, the screenplay was by John Campbell Jr., who wrote the story Who Goes There. That's what The Thing is based on. The DP...
Oh, by the way, Bill Lancaster, the son of Burt Lancaster, I found out.
Oh, no.
Yes.
How about Nepo babies.
Did not know that.
Yeah. They everywhere.
DP was Dean Cundey, who also did Who Framed Roger Rabbit and very famously Jurassic Park.
Apollo 13.
Sam, do you like Jurassic Park?
I do enjoy it. I like The Lost World as well. I think that gets a bad rap, but that's a whole other conversation. And so, interestingly enough, this movie came out in the summer of 1982, and this was the summer of Blade Runner, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, E.T., The Extraterrestrial, which at the time was the highest grossing motion picture of all time. And this film actually did not find a huge audience in that summer. It's in the years that followed, become a huge cult hit and following. But that summer, the worldwide gross was only 19 million. It was kind of sort of the, which is interesting. Maybe it was the marketing, like Nathan was saying, but it was kind of, it's sort of the anti-ET horror darkness alien. It's a really good film. And I have to give a shout out to Rob Bottin's amazing visceral visual practical effects in this movie, which are unreal. And
best
case for like not using CGI. It's just like, I mean, even though CGI, this is 1982 we're talking about, but incredible visual, I mean, just, you know, practical effects.
Yeah.
Those are just some basic tidbits about the movie in general. If anything you guys want to add.
You mentioned the summer of 82. This wasn't just about the summer of 82. June of 1982. I actually want to just compress the time frame of all this. This came out the same day, I believe, as Blade Runner.
Oh my God.
June 25th. Easy to think that. Now, neither movie was considered a success at the time. I don't know what Blade Runner was made for, but Blade Runner only grossed, I think, $41 million, I think maybe on a $30 million budget. So neither one was a success. And also, 2 weeks before that was E.T., which, as we all know, that was, at the time, I think the highest grossing movie ever.
At the time, like E.T. played in the theater for like a year or something like that. It was just like a phenomenon, yeah.
And just before E.T., a week before that, was both Star Trek II on June 4th and Poltergeist also.
Yeah, and those did well. Like those were, I mean, E.T. was the juggernaut, but Star Trek II and Poltergeist were like healthy summers.
What a month of cinema, really.
Yeah. If you're like an average family, how do you decide what to go to? You know,
yeah, but I feel like there's something for everyone here. I mean, not every kid is gonna. I mean, E.T. is for the children.
Yeah,
they're not gonna watch Poltergeist. They're not gonna watch The Thing. They're not gonna watch Blade Runner. Also, Annie came out that month as well on June 18th.
Bambi was around this time too.
Bambi also, yeah. So it was a very memorable month if you were alive that time to get to the theater. It was quite a time.
What an incredible summer. Yeah.
I didn't know any of those movies. Only E.T.
No.
Only E.T. I don't know any other movie at that time.
Blade Runner is kind of a neo-noir. I don't think that one's for you. But Annie, you know Annie, right? This song coming out tomorrow. Yeah.
I didn't care for it. I still don't care for Annie.
Okay, but you know it.
I know it now, but then I didn't know Annie.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I only knew E.T.
He is just incredible. Yeah. So that 84 when it was released, or 85 when it came back out again.
So before we started our broadcast, we did our random number generator, and I am going to go first, sharing my thoughts on The Thing, and I will try to keep this brief so we have time to get into our discussion. But I'll just say really quickly, this is simply one of my favorite movies of all time. And it's probably in my top 10, maybe no higher than my top 15. And I'll get into the gushing in a moment. But what's interesting about this film is that it's slowly weaved its way into that position in my life. Because I think over the last 30 years or so, it's gotten there. Because even I will admit that this movie has some major flaws in it. And I can see where someone watching this movie for the first time, which I can't wait to hear from Ellie, because I now didn't realize this. This is the first time you've watched this movie, which I can't wait. My dream is to sit with people who have never seen this movie before and introduce this to them and half watch the movie and half watch their expression. Watches. I've done this on several occasions, and that is such a treat for me to show this movie to people that haven't seen it. I can't wait till maybe my kids will watch it. It will probably never happen. But anyways, so I think this movie, it can be extremely confusing because the storytelling with so many actors, so many characters, so many like white men, except for like two of them, is where they're just really shouting out names. Where's Blair? Where's Childs? Where's McCready? All these names. It's like, it can get really confusing. I've probably seen this movie, no kidding, 30 times in my life. It has taken me over a dozen times, or maybe a dozen and a half times, to fully understand who everybody is in this movie and where everybody is in the geography of this. It is not clear what's going on, but I think it's purposely kind of left ambiguous. And for a while it bothered me, but I've learned to embrace those flaws and understand that it's not supposed to be clear and fully transparent what is going on in this movie. And I now love that about this movie. I think that kind of fuels the paranoia and the anxiety that this movie has. This movie is, I think it's a real litmus test on if you can really find that something that you can sit through and or will drive you nuts. But let me get back on track. I'm going off here. Oh, we talked about this, the groundbreaking practical effects, you know, as you mentioned before, Sam, you know, with Rob Bottin. Unbelievable. I think it's a highlight. The score from Morricone is a chef's kiss on this movie. I think without that, if you were to take the score out of this movie, it would be a quarter of the film. I love that. And I don't know what else. I think those are the major things. Like I said before, several of the moments feel a bit rushed and sloppy around the third act. I think would have made the film a little bit tighter. You know, there's a lot of characters that kind of disappear. There are off-screen deaths that kind of like, well, why do they do it that way? But, you know, maybe it's a nitpick. But overall, this picture, I think, is about as great as it gets when it comes to the world of sci-fi horror. I'm not giving it a perfect 5, even though it is maybe my top 10. I'm giving it a 4.5 just because I don't think it's a perfect film. I won't give it a perfect 5, but I love this film dearly. So that's all I'll say for now until we get into more.
I feel like that was spoilers from my review. Jeez.
So we're going to go. Next up is Ellie.
Okay. Well, so I don't know if the movie was perfect or not. I wasn't looking at it that way from that perspective. I was more into like, I want to see where it goes, like where it takes me. And from the very get-go, like in the opening where they're chasing the dog, and I'm like, no, don't kill the dog. Don't kill the dog. Why are you killing the dog for? I'm like already getting really mad because they're chasing the doggy, and then the doggy comes up to the, like, obviously, the first shot of the movie, I don't understand why they're trying to kill the dog. So my son is watching the film with me too, because by the way, we never seen this movie before.
Carlos hasn't seen this.
No, we.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it was Saturday. Was the first time we watched it ever, and so I'm like, Carlos, are they trying to shoot the dog because the dog is the thing? And he goes, how do I know? I don't know. So I bet you that's the thing in there, right? So that's why, you know, like automatically I'm thinking like that must be the thing. But then it was like, you know, you see all the guys. And in fact, I thought it reminded me of True Detectives this season.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Scientists in True Detectives are all disappear. Something. We don't know yet what got to them. But so here we are. We're watching this film. Everything looks fine. The doggies are there. And next thing you see is the dog attacking the other dogs, and this thing comes out of the doggy. And now that didn't get me. So whatever. It's just like, whatever. I was like, it's not getting to me. It's not getting to me. It was like Nathan says, it was very confusing. Because at one point I'm thinking the doctor was also the doctor and the chief, the captain, whatever, the two old men, they looked the same to me. It was two men that are old in that movie, and they looked the same to me. And so I got confused because when the doctor went to go examine one of the men that got the alien got into them, he grabbed his two hands. He took his arms and he had no more arms.
Oh, yeah. Copper. Dr. Copper, yeah.
That was the doctor.
Richard Dysart, yeah.
But then there was another guy. I don't know who he was, the other older man.
Probably Blair you're thinking of.
Yeah.
No, he didn't have sideburns.
He had the eyebrows.
He had like
Moffat? Moffat?
Moffat had the sideburns.
Oh, he had no hair.
I'm thinking Wilford Brimley then. White guy?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
by the way, I have to say one thing. Wilford Brimley is the same age as me when he made The Thing.
Oh,
what?
Yeah, he's 49. That's
he looks no.
Yes,
it was a different time.
Yeah, like different time.
70 or something.
Yeah, he always looks 70.
Yeah. Anyway,
just an old soul.
So we were just like, Every scene that we see the monster go in, or it was gruesome, and me and Carlos were like, ew! Oh! What the F? Like, the whole movie, we're like, oh, God! Like, you know, our reaction was like to everything, whenever a guy got possessed or whatever. We're like, ew! Oh, that's so freaking gross! But the grossest thing for me, and I'm sure for Carlos too, was the scene where the guy, it looks like a spider.
Mm-hmm.
The head. Yeah. Oh, like, the human head, and it looks like a spider. Oh, that did it. I was like, oh, this is just, I don't like spiders. So I was like, oh, this is so
the head's coming off the body is the best part of it.
That's my favorite.
It's the worst. If I had to give it, oh my God. So it was like so fast paced that there wasn't a moment for you to miss anything. Like you have to, like I wanted to know who was going to get. My thing, my whole thing through the movie was like, who's going to get it first? Who's going to get it next? I turned to Carlos and I say, well, this is the first movie I see where the black guy doesn't get killed right away. Because, you know, you know, usually in this kind of movies, the black guys always get killed right away. But then it was like, oh, look at the guy. The black guys are still around. Look at that. And we kind of watched the whole film guessing who was the next person. We're like, oh, is it him? No. So me and Carlos, we're like sitting here watching the movie like, no, I think he's got it. No, he doesn't have it. No, he has it. No, he doesn't have it. So that was our whole thing in the movie, going trying to guess who was possessed with it. Now, let me tell you about Kurt. I was going to say Kurt Reynolds. Is that Kurt Reynolds? Kurt Russell.
We haven't even talked about the cast in this yet. We usually run down a brief bit of the cast, but go ahead.
So for me, Kurt is like, first of all, so hot. And that hair, oh my goodness. He has a great set of hair. And he does remind me of Jesus. I'm thinking like, he's obviously the hero of the whole movie. But did he die? Does he die at the end?
This is the biggest question.
I can't wait to talk about the end.
So I'm just, all the people that I thought was the one that had it were not the ones that had it. So the movie had me going for a while. I actually was entertained with this movie. I'm not into alien movies, but I did like this movie. It was entertaining. The dialogue was stupid. Sorry. I didn't care for it. Mostly the dialogue is about, give me the fire, shoot the fire. I'm like, okay. But the action and the effects, the, what do you call that? The
makeup
effects were awesome. Yeah. I mean, if I had to give an MVP to anyone, I'd give it to the alien. The alien gets the MVP because he's just freaking awesome, disgusting, ugly, and he's like a parasite. It's a parasite that goes into your system and it eats you and it becomes you. And then I was like, Carlos, we could possibly have people like this already walking the earth. Yeah, like seriously, we don't know, Nathan could be an alien and we wouldn't know it, you know?
That would explain a lot, but... I'm so sorry, Nathan. She set me up for that. I can't.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. I as opposed to you, Nathan, I didn't see the imperfections, but I wasn't looking into that. I was more into enjoying the whole action and trying to figure out who had the alien inside and who was going to survive. And the people that I thought was going to be alive didn't make it.
Ellie, what's your rating for this?
I'll give it like a 4.
Okay. And, you know, I want to say one thing before I pass on to Sam. You know, I almost don't, obviously this is an alien type movie, but I almost don't even think of it as that. I almost kind of see this as a psychological compression chamber movie where it's really just about a movie about paranoia and dread and keeping the audience, giving them this awful unbalanced feeling and testing us as to how much can we take of that before we break, you know? And the alien part of it is just kind of like
the vehicle
for it. Exactly. You know? So beautiful, Ellie. That's kind of how I look at this.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely.
I can see how that could be that way too. Like, yeah. You know, because it does keep you like, the alien is like a pandemic, you know? Mm-hmm. We had a virus going around that was killing us. Mm-hmm. And it was hurting our mind. It was like messing up with our, you know, mental being, you know, in the house the whole time. So think about, you know, we had COVID and that's a virus. And this alien is like a virus.
Right? Well, we can also talk a little bit like how this might compare a little bit to the AIDS breakout in the early 80s as well. You know, yeah. But we'll get to that. Let's get to Sam.
So I really, really like this movie. And I have seen this film a couple times. The first time I saw it, I never saw it like in the theater or at a screening, but I first saw it back in 2007 and I had like a fever and the flu. And this was a movie that I chose to watch and it was a
about infection.
Harrowing, like it was a fever dream nightmare of an experience where I was kind of in and out, but I was in the world of the movie. And so that like really hooked me. No, and I agree with a lot of you guys. I think what's interesting about this film, structurally wise, is that the horror and the situation comes on hard and heavy really early on. It's there's a slow burn as things happen, but like the threat arrives immediately. And some other films, you know, like Alien or things like that, you know, choose to sort of hide the monster and make it ambiguous. I've always been sort of fascinated by this movie has the shocking approach of when you see the like practical effects or the creature morphing, trying to replicate like a dog skin, instead of kind of hiding it in the shadows, you get this very graphic, like you see everything, you see all the makeup work. So it has a slight shock value to it. And if anything, this isn't really a criticism, just a minor observation, but the one thing with this movie is it is amazing the first time and it's still always good the more you see it, but I can't replicate that same terror.
I know.
You know the beats. You know, the one that always got me a few times that I would always forget is when the guy has the what are the things when you press on someone's chest when you're defibrillator and it goes right through because there's no setup for that. You don't think something's coming. I love how these shock moments happen or when they're testing.
Yeah.
What makes that so great is it breaks the rule of threes because you always expect something's going to happen on the third one and it happens. Right. And twice in this movie, they get you on the second and it happens. I think when they're doing the blood test where Kurt Russell, MacReady, does the whole thing where he sticks the thing in there. It comes when you don't expect it. You expect it to happen not at that moment. I mean, I know it's coming all the time, but it always gets me still. And and when Richard Dysart's doing the defibrillator on Norris, that moment gets me as well because I expect it to happen not at that time, but the next time. And it gets me, and it's always the second time he goes in.
Can I just say something? To me, it was very interactive, this film. Like, it was very interactive with the audience. Because, like you just said about the Petri dish where he's testing the blood, as an audience watching this film, I'm like, is it this one? Is it that one? I love that.
It's a beautiful exercise in suspense, that whole blood test.
Quentin Tarantino likes this movie a lot. And like Quentin Tarantino was saying, the reason why he likes it, like, you know, you guys are talking about like the fourth wall is that you'd almost, in the best possible way, you almost don't feel safe in the audience because it's like the paranoia and the fear is kind of like escalating out of the screen. So it like, you feel like you're a bit in it, like immersed, like Ellie was saying, you're not quite separated from it. I like the when the confusion and the paranoia sets in, you don't know who's infected and who's not infected. One thing I honestly would have been fascinated to see more of, and it certainly doesn't detract from the film, but I love Wilford Brimley's full realization of the magnitude of what's happening. Like he just figures everything out so much quicker than everyone else. And then he goes nuts, but he disappears for a while. And somehow he manages to like superhumanly build this getaway spaceship underneath his shack. And you're like, I like the enigmatic nature of it, but it's like, when did he have time to do that or lift that? Or like, I just wanted a little bit more with that because I was fascinated by that. But overall, the paranoia, the sort of confusing nature adds to it because the alien is, you know, the presence is taking over. I would say my only confusion, and it got better with time with multiple viewings, because I mean, I've enjoyed the movie many times, is that the I was never quite sure of the alien process of imitating others. And then sort of, I always wondered, is it one that was shape-shifting and it's just one creature shape-shifting? Then I realized, no, it infects all the people and all the people.
They say it, the cell. I mean, Kurt Russell kind of explains it like the cells are all part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole life cycle of this thing is 100% left like ambiguous and unknown. And that would makes it kind of scary as well. There is no explanation. Even now watching this movie 25 plus times and with a prequel to this movie as well, it is still not fully explained how the life cycle of this alien is. And that makes this thing scary because we don't know. And there are no real rules to it, which makes it really unnerving.
And I really like that the explanation scene in the middle when they're like figuring out how it multiplies, because it like it helps you navigate it as an audience member. But I just love that I especially like when they go to like the Norwegians' camp and like even the like, older that's still so stylistically cool, like the giant matte painting of like the ship sunk in the earth. Mm-hmm. That place is so creepy and so well done. I just like the sense of impending doom and dread in this movie creeps in, and you know that the dog is not what it seems. And I must say, the alien dog, that is the best canine actor ever in the movie.
We've seen some good dog acting lately, but that dog takes the cake.
Excellent, because it's just, I don't know how they're doing it, or like, but like the pauses and the nut and. Especially like uncomfortably walking in with its own kind, like in the cage. And why am I here? You know, like just fascinating. So yeah, I would give the movie a strong 4. I'd be 4. Like I there's like minor imperfections, but it's such a unique high example of it's so like high concept and terrifying and claustrophobic, and just it's an experience watching that movie. Thumbs up the thing. It's my
review. You even forget that you're watching a 1982 film you're watching this
movie. Oh yeah,
it's like
it feels like something that like Eli Roth could have made in the last couple of years. Yeah, you know, it's that kind of level of quality.
You mentioned the music, Nathan. Like at the beginning, when they're like looking at, they get the first look at like the creature that, you know, the thing was trying to blend with the creature. It's like a mess of faces and legs.
I love that.
And there's this undercurrent, like when I liked how when everyone is silent, because like terror is setting into that. It's like, it's not like they go outside and find like some like dead deer outside, some random, I mean, like imagine being in that situation and seeing that and just being like, what the hell is going on around here? And like, there's no question. It's not like one guy believes there's a creature and everyone else is like, you're crazy, man. Like they all get the picture early on in the movie. Like we have got a serious problem here in the Antarctic, fellas. Like,
I want to talk more about the creature design and all that in a little bit, but let's hear from B.
Yeah. You guys are right on the money. This movie rules. I love it so much, but this was, for me, like instantly one of my favorite films. Like I saw this movie and I was like, oh, this is what movies could be. This is so cool. I think it's a masterclass in paranoia. And when I talk about, you know, one of my big movie pet peeves is pacing in a film when movies are really unevenly paced, I feel that. And for me, I think this is just such a masterclass in like carrying tension effortlessly scene to scene and just not really ever making you feel the lull or feel like it's dragging or feel like you're getting too much all at once. It's just really well done. It's super tight. I think the blood test is one of the best movie scenes of all time. I think that scene is incredible. And I think this is a movie that you can really tell where like the whole crew was just like in harmony. You could just tell that everybody was singing together. This is the year after Escape from New York, right? So you've got Carp and Kurt year two back in action. I think even the Morricone score, and I love Morricone, but he's like doing his best John Carpenter for this score. Like he is just totally in the zone for what this movie is. And I think it's the perfect atmosphere. Nathan, you talk about it as like a psychological thriller. I also think it's kind of a slasher. You know, it does a great job at like unique deaths. And I also think that's where like the flaw of the film, where there's 12 characters and maybe they make up like two whole three-dimensional people altogether.
But I disagree in a lot of ways, because I think they do a really good job giving each of these characters strong character moments. There's 12 characters, but no two of them really are the same. And again, some of them are minor versus others, but they all have very different personalities. And like, I love the relationship between like David Keith, who plays Childs, mm-hmm. and Palmer, who are both the two pot smoking mechanics. Mm-hmm. You know, they have great chemistry. And I think, you know, with Windows and Wilford Brimley, Windows is the radio guy, and mm-hmm. he's always paranoid throughout the entire movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Palmer's a great antagonist. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying we're still getting them confused as we're talking about them.
That is the problem. I agree. Yes.
There's a lot of them. Sure, they have snippets of individuality, but I wouldn't say that they're all like as fleshed out as the Russell or Childs in this character, or even Palmer to some degree. And so, and with each death being as unique as it is, it kind of did feel a little bit of that Carpenter slasher. I say that as a huge compliment. I think that's sort of the payoff of the film. I think the VFX, the tension, I also think the ending of this movie is just really poetic through its nihilistic lens. I think that's really, because it's the two characters who are doing the most to face the danger consistently, you know, who are going into the abyss head first. And I love seeing them on all their adventures sort of through the snow. I think the atmosphere adds to the confusion. I think you think of that like blizzardy whiteout condition and you feel it. You just feel that sort of it overtaking you. Yeah. It's great. 4.5 for me.
Great. I also feel like, I mean, like, you know, I enjoy John Carpenter, and I won't like get into his other films, but I'll say that he and the material really like this, mm-hmm. his directing was elevated in this movie, where some of his other films I like, but there are some movies that he have where I literally like feel like I'm missing coverage shots that I want and more camera movement. Like, yeah. I just think, but sometimes John Carpenter,
when he gets it, he really sings.
I can feel like sometimes when I feel a little bit of distance from his, like some moments in other films, not all of them, just like a few, but it really works in the thing, like his style, the paranoia, the acting, like it just, everything fires on all thrusters in this movie pretty damn well.
Yeah. I love Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness. I think that's a more underrated Carpenter movie, but it kind of reminds me a little bit of when he was just like firing on all cylinders. I think that's a great one too.
Yeah. Okay. I like Fog. I think the fog is
great,
but like, I'm not incredible, but I like it, but he has more like, there's more like directorial things that irritate me with that movie. Just minor stuff in this thing. It works really well. And by the way, I know we're not doing this, but like, Mark Wahlberg would fit in the world of the thing. He could be anybody in this movie, you know?
I told Carlos at the end of the movie, I said, well, if the alien doesn't get him, the cold will.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk about the ending of this movie too. I can't get over, like, you know, this is our fourth snowy survival movie. And this, to me, like, we had people literally stranded on mountains for the last three movies. And to me, this is the most atmospheric film. And it's a certified wet movie. It's filled with crazy prosthetics and gore. It's the most supernatural of the three. And to me, it feels the most, like, claustrophobic.
And the most plausible, too, right?
Society of the Snow, it'll never happen.
Because the most likely that we'll have like a pandemic that will just destroy all of mankind.
Yeah, there's a lot of different levels.
the reason I like the ending, because like as frustrating sometimes as ambiguous endings can be, when you're like, no, I wanted a payoff or I wanted this. This ending elevates the movie.
Yes.
Into like being on the top tier, because like it's not like, you know, Russell Crowe has a showdown with a creature and like kicks his ass and he's like, take that, slime. And he like, he like puts some gasoline in like a helicopter and flies off by himself. And that goes into more like happy action movie ending. But this ending makes it a true classic of like, also the stakes are incredibly high because it's like they are
the world could end
of the potential end of the world. And when you leave in the movie, you're like, I don't know what happened. And that's the point, because the movie doesn't want to, it would be a tonal imbalance to let you out of the terror and let you off the hook. The whole point of that movie is like putting you on a hook and keeping you on the hook. And then you don't get at the end and you're like, damn, that was intense.
Yeah. I think you can totally read it as not ambiguous. I think they just sublimate into the alien.
Well, that's what I want to hear. You know, there's as many fan theories as there are people that watch this movie. What do you all think happens at the end of this?
I honestly don't have an opinion as to what happens, but I like the fact that the ending is directed in a way that you could interpret it any way you want to. Yes, they could be the aliens and it's over. It could just be Kurt Russell and he could have been taken over a long time ago. You don't know. That's the point. And I think the brilliance of that moment is that it leaves it open to you on purpose. Even if John Carpenter had something in mind, and maybe he did, I haven't like read up on it, but like, I just like the fact that you can take away from that ending what you want. And I feel like that's totally on purpose, you know?
So you're not going to play ball here.
Well, I am playing ball by saying that I cannot play ball because like I don't have an opinion myself.
Okay.
My like eye is just on the ball of the directing. And I'm like, damn, that was perfect.
My opinion is that if the alien didn't get him, the weather will get him. So either or, he was gonna disappear out of this earth.
Okay. So,
I have a little bit of optimism. One of them might not be. I have a little bit of hope. I'm a hopeful guy.
Yeah. But no matter whether, here's my thought, all right, because I'm going to jump in here. Whether or not either of them are infected by an alien or not doesn't matter, because at the end of the winter, the rescue team is coming. They're going to find them, whether they are frozen or not, with an alien inside of them, or they're going to find the burnt crisp of that other Blair monster somewhere, and this whole thing's going to start all over again. They're going to take that back to civilization. So America,
so what's the purpose?
The world is fucked.
What's no the matter purpose what? Of the alien? The purpose of the alien is just to get somebody's body and become that person. What's the purpose of the alien?
Because once it takes over any, like if the alien takes over the entire planet, then it can control everyone with one mind, and like it, you know, they could all work together and do its bidding or something like that. That's what
I love when bad guys don't have motives. Yeah. Sometimes they're just bad.
Take over like the Borg.
This is not a bad guy. It's an alien.
It's killing people though. You know, the antagonist of the movie, Ellie.
This is where. It is a little frustrating to me about the intelligence of this alien, because is this, first of all, this alien just kind of like rips out of your skin and goes, you know, it seems to have no control over anything.
And it does it awesome.
Yet this thing also knows how to build a spaceship. You know, like it seems to have the focus to build like this machinery, but also it can't control itself to hide. It's dumb and brilliant at the same time. It's chaotic is what it is, which makes it even scarier in some ways, because it seems to have no control over itself.
He's not eating the body. He's not eating the humans, because he's not feeding off the humans. He just wants to use the humans for what? What's the purpose?
Again, this is it. You're asking the question.
But like, maybe we're seeing the aliens in like their larvae stage, you know? Like maybe they just haven't grown up yet into spaceship building aliens. They're fresh out of a human.
And we don't know the whole, again, we've talked about, we don't know what the what the life cycle is of this. What I, you know, we talked a little bit about the creature effects here and how when Blair opens it up, you see like the layers upon layers of this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of a key to this whole thing. We are seeing a glimpse into this creature's history, all the planets it's visited and the species mm-hmm. that it's absorbed into its life cycle. This is like something that's foreign to us.
Yeah, it looks like this creature cannot make it through the heat. So if it gets, you know, if they lose the eyes, it's gonna die in the heat because when they burn them, it dies.
Yeah, but this is not like a normal humanoid type alien, like with a bone structure and brain and stuff like this. Is like something that humans cannot comprehend as an intelligent being. And that's what is so scary and unusual about this. It's never been depicted in a movie before. That's why I love this.
That's what I love. Exactly. That's what I love about it, because what they're up against is so foreign and hard to understand and like just out of – it's just like out of their depth. You know what I mean? Like one thing, if you were in the woods in Alaska and there was like a grizzly bear and a member of your team had been eaten, but it still is within nature. You're like, all right, this is really terrible, but here's some things we could do.
If it bleeds, we can kill it, but it's not the same type of thing. You know?
Exactly. Like it's just, I just feel like the thing, whatever the thing is, its purpose is on some other level. And it's like, I'm just a consumer of worlds. I just like,
It's almost supernatural. It's almost supernatural, so you can't fight it.
And like that only came off a portion of that ship. Like who knows what else is inside that frozen ship?
You know, I have to say one thing. Always kind of drove me nuts is that when they go back the second time and they discover that ship, do they not go inside that ship?
I know. I was such cynical thinking because this is how my brain works. And like, open. But like when there's the shot, a matte shot of them on the exterior, and I was like, I hadn't seen the movie in a while. I was like, ooh, are they going to cut to a close-up moving doll inside of them? I'd be like, oh, but in order to do that, they'd have to build a set. And sure enough, it just cut to another match. I was like, okay, so they didn't build anything there. It's a great match shot, though. But, like, damn, they should have gone and, like, I mean, I don't know. Well, I want to see what's inside.
It's not even a reference that they even, like, went in. Like, we looked inside and, you know. I mean, I would imagine if they're a research team, they would have definitely like poked a head in there like what is this thing.
I mean, they have, you know, the bigger fit, they, you know, the urgent problem.
By the way, what kind of research facility is this? This place is stocked with armory, guns, grenades, dynamite, flamethrowers. What the hell were they researching?
Norwegians.
I think they're doing like Antarctic scientific like work, but they've got a whole bunch of, they've got an arsenal, and like, man, their radio sure sucks, you know, like
but like they were ready for like the Russian invasion.
That was one plot line where they like lay it on thick. He's like, I'm trying on the radio. I'm like, I got it, the radio doesn't work. All right. That was mean, like, you know.
But they didn't know. I mean, they had that whole arsenal and they had no idea what Lovecraftian horrors were in store for them.
What is it with humans and they're enamored with the aliens things? Like, we humans are so enamored with the idea of aliens.
I don't know. I'm enamored by it too, and I don't even know how to explain it. I think there's just in this movie.
I'm enamored by your question.
I like think about it after the movie. I even told Carlos, I was like, what is it about humans that we're so enamored with the idea of aliens and them visiting us and we encountering aliens? And what is it that makes us so obsessed with that?
And not only are we obsessed with aliens, but humans' versions of aliens, either they're like way more advanced than us, or they're super, but they're always an extreme version of our like unknown fear. Mm-hmm. Like when we never picture aliens as like some humanoid person just like flying up in a Jeep being like, hey guys, I'll show you my planet, you know?
Yeah. There are like, there are vehicle for existentialism.
Yeah.
Good or bad. Yeah.
And I kind of like, I mean, I don't know. I feel like this movie also, there's something primal about it. Like it hits some kind of deep terror. Like there's almost a feeling
of, you know,
like,
what's going to happen, Sam? We're going to manifest these aliens into Earth. It's what's going to happen. Because the more we think about it and you know how the mind works, you know, and as a collective, if as a collective, we continue to do that, we're going to make them come.
So. It would be awesome if they came here because hopefully they're nice, but the aliens would probably have like incredible camera equipment. And like, if they lent it to us, we could like elevate our movie.
You know, Sam, you know why they would never come to Earth? Do you want to know why?
Because I don't know why. I was trying to say something smug, but I got nothing.
Because to the aliens, and I believe we're not alone in this universe, galaxy, whatever. We are like little ants. Insignificant. So they would not care to come and deal with someone or people as insignificant as we
that's,
are.
That's because they haven't seen Gremlins 2. If they've seen Gremlins, yeah.
Or they haven't met Ted yet.
Or if they need a little bit of water, they could come to our oceans, but there's probably massive ocean planets.
Yeah, they're probably like, these idiots, look at them. They can't even get along with each other. No, we're not.
I will
going
say,
there.
And I just a quick comment. I totally believe in life on other planets. Like, I'm 100% with you, Ellie.
Me too.
I do get the sense that wherever we are, doesn't seem like we're in the most happening part of the galaxy. Like, I feel like we're kind of an isolated planet. Distances are huge anyway, but our neck of the woods feels a bit like a quiet corner of the
our civilization compared to the other civilizations out there in the universe, we are like the bottom of the civilizations in the universe. That's how not smart we're not that smart at all compared to those people up there, so that's why we're at the bottom.
How do you know?
Because I talk to them. I know these things.
Oh my God.
They come to me.
That's why we have to be their friends, so we can get that awesome camera equipment. And like, they would,
Haven't you ever read the book by Misham? Misham, what's his name? He's a Japanese guy. I met him, by the way.
What book?
You know?
Misham. Hold on, I'll tell you what's his name.
This movie too is so interesting. Like, we're in the beginning of the Reagan years here, right? Like, misinformation, public distrust. And then this like otherworldly force that's slowly seeping away the camaraderie and, I don't know, just eroding everyone's sense of togetherness until they're just undulating alien life forms. Can we talk about favorite deaths? Can we all just do our favorite deaths?
Yes, I think this might segue into it because I just want to talk a little bit about the blood test. We haven't really talked much about that.
Oh, one of the best movie scenes of all time? Sure, I'll talk about it.
I'm probably going to botch this line, but I got to throw it in there when I get the chance. I can't remember the exact line. He's like, you know, I know you guys have been through a lot and all, but if you get a moment, would someone untie me from this fucking chair?
Stop, Sam, because I have it here.
Yeah.
I know you gentlemen have been through a lot. And when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch!
And that's you know, yeah. There's not a lot of humor in this movie, but it's so precisely brought in every once in a while, and it needs that levity. And
the first time I saw this movie, I got like guffawed out loud at that line. It was such a relief. I was like, that was so funny.
And there's another moment where Palmer turns around and you see like Norris as the spider creature, and he goes like, "You gotta be fucking kidding me," which is another great moment. There aren't a lot of these moments in the movie, but it's the timing of these moments are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought about capturing that, but these standalone moments, they're not that funny. But
yeah,
in the moment, in the scenes, they offer the perfect moment of levity.
Exactly.
Yeah. Roller skating.
Yeah.
That always tickles me.
Of a billion Hiroshima bombs.
What was that?
It was DiCaprio saying something about a billion Hiroshima bombs.
Okay, that's
great.
I don't
know where that came from.
But the blood test, I want to talk about this because it was, first of all, I love the scene. It is one of my favorite scenes of all time. But damn, it is the most flawed idea ever. If you really break it down, it makes no sense at all.
Look who's Mr. Antarctic Alien Science now.
It's not, I mean, like, think about this. It ties up everybody, or a bunch of them, gives them morphine, all right? And it starts, like, drawing blood. It also starts, like, taking a knife. I remember Windows takes a knife, wipes it off on his jeans, goes to the next guy. I mean, the chances of contamination
It was the 80s.
I know, but it's like even a doctor would realize you can't do this. You need another knife. I mean, like.
Yeah, but under the circumstances.
They've already admitted that this thing, all it needs is to like cells like touching each other will contaminate you. Like, and they've already explained that. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. This is. I know this is before the real scare of AIDS, you know, but and people probably didn't think to like not clean needles and stuff like that. But still, like when you have like an outbreak like this, you probably wouldn't do this. They already mentioned before we should prepare our own meals and eat out of cans. They already are scared of contaminating. I know this is a major nitpick, but like it's just like in hindsight, I'm watching this. I'm
do
like,
not ruin cool. one of the greatest scenes,
Nathan. What you don't know, Nathan, is that this is just all about a dream that Curtis having.
What?
That's mm-hmm. just the whole thing. It turns out to be a dream that Kurt was having. McGrady or whatever his last name was. Right. It was just a dream.
He was having a dream, but he woke up as his character from Big Trouble in Little China, and he was like,
But nonetheless, that side, the science behind this, in hindsight, I'm like, this is stupid. But anyways, and then like they have them tied up. And once that they find out that somebody isn't the thing, they're still like have them tied up and they go into the next guy. And then Palmer explodes into the monster and the guy next to them is tied up. And like, it's just like, so like, it makes great cinema, but it's just like a ridiculous moment. I feel bad for
him. I think the whole, next to him. The whole movie was supposed to be that way though. Not.
Oh, I know. It's a beautiful moment, but it's just like, what are these poor bastards sitting?
Oh yeah, when what's his name is basically being like eaten. He's like in his head. And he's just like thrashing him around. Yeah. And, oh my god.
Yeah. I always get the sound the copper wire makes when they're not the alien, when it's just screeching against the petri dish.
Yeah.
And that blood. Oh, every time that just goes right up my spine.
Yeah, like nails on the way the blood like avoids it and jumps out, like recoils. It's just like,
you know, it's really cool. There's a great, I have the Scream Factory Blu-ray, and there's all these great special features documentaries and how they did all that stuff. That hand where Kurt Russell puts the wire onto it, his hand that reaches out at you is a fake hand.
Oh shoot!
So that's all a prop hand. So it's his real hand putting on here. But I know the audience at home can't see me. But the hand that's holding the petri dish is a plastic hand. So that's all a rig.
Whoa!
Yeah,
you can't even tell.
What's great is that a couple shots before that, it's set up where he puts it in there and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you buy it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's some great documentaries on that Blu-ray. If anybody wants to borrow that, now I watched like everything on it this past week.
Yeah,
I was just thinking that, like, even though it's a different movie, like this is completely not like The Exorcist at all. But the first Exorcist in this film have similar shock value, where you just see things that you have not seen in another film, and in some ways, even though The Exorcist is more classic, I feel like some of the makeup effects in the 1982 The Thing are timeless, because even if someone watches this 20 years from now, you're aware that it's like, you know, creature effects work, but it's so impressive and so disgusting anyway that it doesn't lose its luster, kind of.
And I think there's like, you know, you're looking at something fake anyway, so the degree of artificiality that you're looking at kind of takes a back seat. You know, like, you know, you're not looking at someone's head sloughing off a table, you know. So the fact that it's practical effects, sort of, you can play with the fakeness of it.
Okay. We're gonna take a break in a moment and get to our concluding thoughts in this. But I want to ask you guys a question. Has anybody here either seen the 1951 Howard Hawks produced film, The Thing from Another World, or the prequel that came out in 2011?
I have not seen either of them, and now I wish to.
Now I want to.
Fascinated, but yeah.
Okay. I was just curious.
Favorite deaths.
You've been wanting to talk about this.
Mine is Vance. It's his head sloughing off the table and then turning into a crazy spider. It's
perfect. Yes. I guess I'd have to agree. with that, and that's Norris who has the cardiac arrest and is on the table. I don't know. I mean, also, I mean, I think of Richard Dysart and the way that he, his arms are chopped off. I mean, maybe that. I mean, that is so shocking out of nowhere. You don't expect that. I think that's the most unexpected death in
there.
It is.
I'm trying to think if there's another one that is that reaches that level. Has to be Richard Dysart.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such an awful way to go.
I think.
And that's Copper. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that really has that.
What if my this is laughing?
Who else is? What, you know, there's a couple off screen deaths on this as well. Oh, sorry, Sam, go ahead.
No, I'd say my favorite death is that the Norwegian guy that gets shot at the very beginning.
Oh my god! Oh my god! I said we had to rewind that scene with me and Carlos because I was sitting and I watched him and I said, Carlos, just see the way that dude fell down on the ground after he gets shot. It's the funniest thing to see. It just goes like that, and then he, like, I don't know. It's just so funny, and we had to rewind it and watch it again. So
and it's just such a, like, an unexpected, I thought it was going to be a problem, and he just, like, gets shot in the face and falls over. You're like, well, I guess that's the last we'll hear from him.
I mean, so many of these characters die off screen, and it in some ways, like I said before, it frustrated me sometimes. Like, we never really see how Blair was infected and how he died. We just see that he got overtaken by the thing. We see Palmer die, but
I can't tell how isn't it's pretty ambiguous as to when Wilford Brimley is.
We never know.
It seems you think it's. I thought that he was, like, overwhelmed with the burden of his intelligence of knowing what's going to happen, and he can't handle it, and he cracked. Mm-hmm. I was like, but did he already?
I think so.
I don't know. Yeah.
My theory is that he does. He knows that they're doomed, and the only way that he feels that he can actually prevent the alien from getting to civilization is to destroy the radio and the helicopter and all that. That is actually Wilford Brimley kind of like losing his mind, trying to do whatever he can do to make sure that nobody gets away from the alien doesn't leave.
But I do think
that my theory is that the alien has taken over Wilford Brimley. When you see him, when they go out to him, have you seen the Kurt Russell asks, have you seen somebody? And he's saying, I feel better now. I'm sorry. I want to come back inside. My gut is he's turned by then, because that's a whole different demeanor for him. And he's asking to come back into the group.
Total different demeanor. And he's been out there for like a while. Like,
and I love the noose that's hanging down in the middle of the shot. I love that.
That's a good point. That's a really good,
And, you know, so we see Norris die. We see Clark get shot in the head very quickly. And Fuchs is the one that is turned, and he's got the hands that have turned into the alien, and they torch him out in the snow.
That's a very very memorable death. It's just like, my God, it's just like horrible.
Yeah.
The one death, and I want to wrap this up soon. The one death that has always kind of bothered me is, and again, it's really confusing because all these names here is. I think it's Bennings, because we never see really what happened to him. That's the character that they find, like, his glasses. Is it Bennings? Or am I getting him? No, I think it's Bennings. Oh, wait. Maybe.
Well, they find his glasses in the snow, right?
No, Fuchs. I think it's Fuchs. Yeah, Fuchs is the one where they find his, maybe it's body or his glasses out in the snow, and they're like, is it Fuchs? We're not really sure. It's kind of ambiguous. Did, like, Fuchs torch himself? Did he kill himself? Did the thing somehow get him? It's never really explained what happened to him, and I don't like that it's not really, you know, I mean, it kind of adds to, like, the paranoia of what's going on, but I don't know. It just feels kind of like hand wavy. We're just going to forget him and move on.
I don't know. Stuff like not knowing exactly every death does kind of aid us as viewers in the end when we're not sure if someone has been infected.
Yep. And same with the character played by T.K. Carter, Knowles. He just kind of walks off in the underground area, and we never hear or see him again. And we assume that the thing gets him, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. and we never hear him like scream or anything, you know. He's just gone. You know, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think to some casual viewers that expect like this typical monster movie, this would just drive them insane. You know, not having that kind of, you know, tying up these loose ends to this movie. So it's kind of like you have to kind of reconcile with these decisions in this, that that's what how they did this. I don't know.
I think for me, like the structure of these types of films really matter, like how the narrative plays out and how the fear escalates and how we're drawn in. And it sets everything up so well in the first act that when we get into that time where there's a little bit more chaos and some characters are dropped and it's more confusing, you're on board because you establish the situation. And so what could be just like mediocre filmmaking, like, oh, we forgot about that character, you give it the benefit of the doubt because of the situation that they're in, that it like elevates that feeling of like, oh, well, that character disappeared, but we don't know, but that's okay because the atmosphere is terrifying, if that makes sense.
Sam, does this film pass the Scotch whiskey litmus test for a film for you? It has to. It's practically sponsored by J&B.
Yeah, you know, I love the I was on board with the opening of this movie when like Kurt Russell's playing chess with a computer and he loses and he like pours his J&B into the hard drive and destroys it. I'm thinking you're in the Antarctic and you're not going to be able to play chess. You just wrecked the motherboard. Like, you're going to regret that, man.
By the way, that was the only female casting in the entire movie. That was John Carpenter's wife at the time, Adrienne Barbeau.
Oh, no way.
Yes.
No way.
Escape from New York, Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Technically the first casualty in the film, by the way.
There was a woman in the film?
That's voice of the chess game.
Yeah. That was John Carpenter's wife. She's an actress. She was in Escape from New York or Swamp Thing. I think
that doesn't really constitute being a woman in the film, does it?
She was cast.
Okay, I guess. Her voice was cast, not the actual image.
Voice casting counts.
No.
Okay. I'm not going to argue. All right. Let's take a break for a moment. I'm just going to do a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to get to our final thoughts and wrapping up our review of this. So we would just like to thank you for tuning into our show. Your feedback would be greatly appreciated. So if you agree or disagree with our opinions, reach out to us. Our email is backtotheframerate@gmail.com. You can reach us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, TikTok at backtotheframerate. Also on Twitter or X, not the drug, @backframerate. Sign up for our newsletter, Back Framerate Monthly. Best way right now to reach us is just by emailing us at backtotheframerate@gmail.com. And also we have our website, backtotheframerate.com, where you can find all of our episodes on dozens of platforms. And I just want to say for one more week, a shout out to a new podcast that is on the Westin Media Podcast Network called You've Never Seen with Joey Haskins. He just celebrated his 1-year anniversary of his show. 36 episodes, I think, are available now. And if that doesn't even include another 15 that aren't about movies, which is pretty cool. So I think there's a total of 51 episodes that are available. So congratulations, Joey, for a full year of your show You've Never Seen. So check that out. And you can go to westinmedia.org/podcasts. And yeah, check that out. So let's get to our conclusion of our review. We're going to do our MVP of the movie and our final thoughts and our verdict if we're going to save this film or purge it into the fiery abyss of the asteroid apocalypse. Because we're going to go with the same order that we did for our review, well, I'll just say that my MVP, if I can find it here, you know, we talked about this a couple of times. Sam, you originally brought it up. When we think of this film, I think the first thing that people usually think of is the groundbreaking practical effects they're revolutionary, and that's why I think the thing has become a cult hit and is so beloved and referenced to this day. There was a large team of people that contributed to the effects, and the one of them that I think the biggest names in Hollywood we haven't talked about yet was Stan Winston, who designed the creature that came out of the dog. But most of the effects were shepherded by the department helmed by Rob Botten, and you know, they went with, you know, originally there was a lot more stop motion effects I was reading in this. And somewhere along the line, they just said the stop motion was not going to look very good. It wasn't going to age well, which I think was
glad they really, made
I'm so yeah. glad they didn't do
Such
that.
The right choice.
It would have looked like Clash of the Titans or something like that. And yeah. I think that it was a great decision not to do that. But anyways, the practical effects are my MVP in this, so I'm actually going to give it to Rob Botten because what he did was revolutionary, and if it wasn't for what he did, this, you know, I don't know if this movie would have the status it has now. So he is my MVP.
Yeah. Then if I'm going to give it, I'm going to give the MVP to the scene where the guy turns into a spider because it was like freaking awesome.
Spider head, yes.
Crazy.
Crazy.
Crazy scene, yeah.
All right, Sam, what's your MVP?
My MVP would really have to be that the Stan Winston helmed moment where like the dog explodes into the creature in the containment with all the other dogs, because for me, that's the first moment in the movie where the horror really breaks through, because before that, we've seen a dog, we've gotten a creepy atmosphere, but it, you know, horror hasn't really set in, and that scene is just like a gore fest of terrifying blood and creature design, and it kind of sets the horror tone for the rest of the movie. So that's definitely my MVP. That scene I find frightening.
Yeah.
Good.
By the way, this is probably before like there were animal wranglers on set to make sure dogs were probably well cared for, because that dog looked pissed. That got sprayed with that whatever that goo was.
Oh yeah, I felt bad for that.
I don't think that would fly today. All right, B, what is your MVP?
MacReady's hat. Talked about it enough.
We did not talk about that enough. No, that was great.
Whenever so someone good. Says, yeah, I just hear one of the characters, the way he goes, MacReady.
What I think I learned in some of the, in John Carpenter's director commentary, is that the hat was not Kurt Russell's original idea, that there was second unit shooting done where the pilot was wearing that hat. And because it was filmed where MacReady was supposed to be he was the helicopter pilot, Kurt Russell had to wear that hat now in all of the helicopter scenes. And he said it looked ridiculous.
I love it. Yeah. I think it's perfect. Yeah, it gives him this sort of like cowboy thing.
It just became part of his character because second unit was the pilot was wearing it or something like that, I think.
I love it.
Yeah, I love that. All right. All right, so now we are going to get to we're going to do our final thoughts in our verdict. We'll do this pretty quickly, and I'll just say that, like I said earlier, this is one of my all-time favorite movies. I don't know why I give this a 5. I just think because it's hard for me to not find some of the flaws in this. I think it is close to one of my perfect film, but I think it does have some things that do kind of scratch my head a little bit. I think there is some story pacing things in the third act that, you know, as much as I kind of love it, I also kind of like wonder, could it have been a little tighter? No. Well, no, it's all a nitpick. I still love this film, and it's great. You know, a lot of people compare this to Alien, and just because it's this, like I said, it's this tight space. It's the cabin in the woods. You know,
dare I ask which you would rate higher, Alien or The Thing? I can't believe it.
Alien.
Me too.
I'm an Alien guy.
I'm an Alien guy.
I think Alien actually might be a perfect film.
Yeah.
There's not a single flaw in that movie for me.
And I love this movie. The thing I'm just saying between the two, Alien for me has a slight edge.
I like this movie better, but I think Alien's probably better made. I think it's the better technical one.
Alien. I think everything about Alien is slightly just well done. I just love the world building. I love how the characters they take an hour just for character development in Alien, and I adore that about that film.
It's another certified wet movie.
Yeah. Wet movie month. We need to do that, right? Just wet movies all month long.
Jason Takes Manhattan. The wettest movie of the month.
I'm not watching any movie.
We're going to get to Alien
I'd
3.
Watch it. Interstellar would be nice.
We definitely, at some point, we have to review Jason Takes Manhattan because movie is just like, most of it takes place on a ridiculous boat. Like, it's ridiculous. I know.
All right. So
is Jason the guy that goes killing people?
He goes killing people.
It's the eighth Jason movie, the eighth installment of the franchise.
Basically, they take a boat to Manhattan and like show up at this like really crappy dock, and they're like barely in Manhattan.
Dude, we don't need Jason in Manhattan. Manhattan already have many Jasons.
That's true. I was thoroughly entertained by Jason. I watched that whole movie one night. I was like, what a ridiculous evening I just had.
I think 7 is actually a good movie, but I really have fun with 8.
I'll watch Jason in Space over any of those any day. So, but just to put a period on this whole thing, yes, I would 100% save this movie, put it in the vault. It needs to be preserved. And that's all I have to say about The Thing, 1982.
I don't know.
You have to pick.
I don't know.
But it doesn't work if you don't pick.
But I don't know if I want it or not.
You're breaking us here.
Can I plead the fifth?
No.
What was the point of that?
I don't know yet. I mean, it was entertaining. Yeah. It was funny. Actually, there's laughing moments for me. I mean, at times I thought it was comedic.
When the dog got shot, I was like, huh?
After a while, I started just... It was shocking moments. But after the shock runs out, you're like, oh, what? this is funny. It's funny. It's just funny to me.
I'm glad you laughed.
I did. Like, at first I was shocked. Then I was like, oh my God, that is too freaking funny. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this film. Because we're going to have so many other ones.
Yeah, but it's going to be as great as this.
Maybe. Maybe.
Well, I think it's rubbish. Bland, early 80s, grotesque, potboiler, sci-fi rubbish. A heaping pile of shit. No, I'm just kidding. 4 stars. That was a joke.
All right. I'm not putting it in the vault. No.
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 I'll put it in the vault just because it's like at the top of its genre. It's like at the top of its class.
No, it isn't, but okay. It is not, but okay.
Put it this way, if our like place was a hotel for movies and like each movie got a room, like The Thing would get like a double queen bed and a decent sized television.
No.
The Thing isn't an extended stay.
Yeah, extended stay. And like other movies that would make it in, like they'd be they'd get maybe like a single like log cabin with like no heat, but like this movie would get some amenities.
It's in the vault for me, man. Yeah, I hard agree.
100%. All right. So
I wouldn't watch it again. I watched it this one time, and that's about it for me.
I hear that.
You need to watch it like another like 25 times to really, really feel it. I can almost quote this whole movie now after seeing it so many times.
I'm good.
Did you guys like it as much as Always? They're so similar.
No, they're
not as much as
Always just sucked, period.
I like Always.
No. That's the most boring film I ever watched. I fell asleep in it.
I take offense to what you say, and I think we all know who I am. My name is Richard Dreyfuss.
I'll watch a Nora film over here.
Let's put The Thing in the vault.
All right, but when you guys watch The Thing, how do we get rid of it?
And maybe we'll watch the prequel sometime. People hate that film.
I would be interested to see what happens to.
And they're watching the prequel or the after prequel.
Oh, so what I have read. If anyone is curious, you know, some people want this movie. This is a standalone film, obviously, but I have read that there is a new film in development with Blumhouse, which was announced back in 2020. Carpenter confirmed that he was involved and it would be a direct sequel. So which seems odd because Carpenter has pretty much said that this is where the story ends.
A direct sequel to what?
The Thing.
Oh, heck no. Why would they do that? No, they shouldn't even know where it is.
Carpenter's famously kind of a grumpy old man. I don't know. He likes money. I can see him doing this.
Oh, but like, yeah, I mean, yeah, he, but
it's 2024, the audience has changed.
It'll come out in, if he's still around, in 2031 would be my prediction, because every 20 years there's another Thing movie.
They should do a crossover with The Thing and The Marvels and like relaunch Encounters of Thing. Like, you know.
No. Not sound. No.
I think it'd be a hit.
All right.
I don't know.
So this concludes our winter survival movie retrospective. What I think we're going to do, we didn't get a chance to really talk offline, but I think what we're going to do is we're going to come back and our next theme is going to be epic romances. Is that we need to get some women, you know, in the movies.
You're begging for a crumb of estrogen here.
I'm sick and tired of watching just men. Although, I mean, some of those guys were hot, but
and I think it's safe to announce the slate of movies that we're going to be reviewing. We have Out of Africa, correct? Right?
Hot.
We have The Notebook.
Hot.
We have The English Patient.
Hot.
And I'm blanking. What is the fourth one?
The Year of Living Dangerously.
No, not that one. It was Beast movie. What was your beat?
It was my movie. What was it?
What, Atonement? Was it?
It was Atonement. I felt very strongly about that. Atonement. Yes.
Atonement. So you have four hot movies that are all going in the vault.
Yes. So we'll sweep you away with romance and love. We haven't figured out, actually, we'll do that after we go offline, what the order of these movies are going to be. But yeah, that's what we're going to be doing this March. So that's exciting. Finally, something
else. You sound so different. Exciting, Nathan, about it.
Hey, you know what? Some of these I haven't seen in a long time. So I am, you know, I'm always up for always changing it up. So that's great. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. Look for those episodes coming out in a couple of weeks. And yeah, looking forward to it. So that will do it for this week. Let me get Tamara. Back to the Frame Rate. It is part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. We wish to thank Brian Ellsworth for our show opening. On behalf of all of us, we bid you farewell from our fallout shelter. Your presence in our underground sanctuary is truly appreciated. We are truly sorry you cannot join us, but we want to express our gratitude for your company. If you are finding solace in our discussions, we kindly ask that you please subscribe and leave a rating and review. Your support is the beacon of light that brightens our confined space. Head over to Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, or whichever portal connects you to our broadcast, and share your thoughts. Until we emerge from the fallout, stay with us, keep hope alive, and keep those reviews coming. This is the end of our transmission. Back to the Frame Rate. Signing off. Woof, woof.
want you to know it's over.
Well. Bye.